Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Talking about part one, chapter eight of Madame Bovary, but first, let me tell you about something from our friend, Simply Productive. Simply Productive has posted a little something-something on the subreddit. A cross post for a subreddit that she is reviving. Let me have a little look at this because I'm not really sure what it's about. But I know that if it's Simply Productive, then it's going to be something awesome. So, Rory Gilmore Book Club. The Rory Gilmore Book Club. They're starting Pride and Prejudice on May the 1st. Starting a discussion for chapters 1 to 12 at that time. Okay, and they go weekly, about 12 chapters per week. So that they're going at a bit of a pace, quicker pace, that's good. Where am I here? Okay, the subreddit's empty at the moment. So it's brand spanking new, but it's a book club. I believe it's got something to do with the show Gilmore Girls and a list of books that's recommended on that show. Something like that. Anyway, go over and have a look. Rory, R-O-R-Y, Gilmore Book Club. The new subreddit where we can hang out. Consider it another sister sub of this one. So, very cool. Thanks for doing that. And, yeah, see you there. Maybe. I can't say I've ever watched the Gilmore Girls, so I don't really understand that aspect of it. But, hey, book clubs are good. All right, part one, chapter eight. Let's rock and roll. Lovely party. Pity about the rest of their lives. That was my discussion prompt. Swim said the mama fishy. I think this was meant to be a response to someone else, actually. I'll come back around to that comment. Correlate said, Emma has moved on from reciting romantic poetry to being insulting and moody, telling Charles he shouldn't dance because everyone would make fun of him was petty, I suppose, but it was nothing compared to suddenly dismissing his dear servant. Up until now, I have been feeling bad for Charles, but at this point, I've kind of lost patience with him. How could he let Natasie go without a fight? If not for his sake, he should have done something for hers. My favourite small moment was Charles standing for 2 hours watching whilst without understanding it. I have been there, pretending to watch a game. Oh, whist. Sorry, the game whist. Watching whist without understanding it. I've been there pretending to watch a game because I was too awkward to talk to strangers. In my case, it's usually chess. Interesting footnotes from the Norton edition. The ladies in the province, unlike their Paris counterparts, do not drink wine at public dinner parties and signified their intention by putting their gloves in their wine glasses. The fact that they fail to do so suggests that Emma the high degree of sophistication of the company. Already popular and frequently performed among the cosmopolitan elite of Europe by the 1790s, the waltz was subject to moral censure well into the 19th century because of the unprecedented close embrace in which the couples dance. Seems that throughout history there's always one thing that's like too risque, and the further back you go, the more mundane that thing is. Like the waltz is like an old person's dance now. It's like the dorkiest old thing. But back then, it was like, oof, it's a bit hot to handle. That's pretty funny. Fun fact, says Swim, said the Mama Fishy, one of Madame Bovary's most memorable chapters might be the one in which Emma attends a ball thrown by one of Charles's patients, the Marquis de Villiers. The event was actually inspired by a real-life dance that Flaubert attended with his parents in 1836 when he was 14 years old, held by a local aristocrat. The experience impressed Flaubert so much that he also described elements of it in his early short story, Quid Vulies. 1837 and in an 1850 letter to a friend. Well, there you go. That event, to some degree, really happened and made a big impact on the author. Simply Productive said, what were the girls putting in the men's hats? Triangles of white. I would say a phone number, but we know that isn't it. For anyone here who has watched Schitt's Creek, Charles is Roland Schitt. He is a man who loves his life, his small town surroundings, his close acquaintances as best friends. He's a little bit pudgy around the stomach, jovial, a bit odd, and absolutely infatuated with his wife. But he's, I don't know, not sophisticated. He's satisfied with who and where he is. Yeah, I like that. I'm actually watching Schitt's Creek at the moment, sort of. I've watched, I think I'm watching season 4, so I've watched 3 full seasons, and I can remember about, I don't know, 5 episodes from all that. It just kind of washes over me, that show. I do enjoy it, but I just pay so little attention to it. It's just background noise for my brain. But yeah, no, I'm watching it, and I appreciate that comparison there. Oh, mate, I fell asleep on my couch, so if I sound a bit out of it, it's because I just woke up from a weird nap that wasn't meant to happen. Small edits are simply productive. I've noticed that someone is consistently downvoting my previous comments, which is a bit unexpected in this sub. If anyone here has an issue with me, please just tell me why. I know I'm not exactly the best quality discussion here, but I'm just trying to learn along with everyone else. I would appreciate the criticism rather than any anonymous downvotes. Thanks. Ooh, subreddit drama. Juicy. I've got to confess, it's me. I just don't like the look of you. So I just hit that down arrow. Whenever I read one of your comments, I just think, screw this guy. And I downvote it. No, I don't think I've ever downvoted anything on this sub. For that matter, I don't really upvote all that much either. I occasionally kind of idly will just give something a little uptick, but not very often. So I'm, yeah, safe. I don't know. Yeah, but what's going on? Who's going around downvoting other people? Silly business. Especially when that person is just sort of part of the conversation. If you had gone in and written something, I don't know, off topic or off color, then maybe. But I don't know. I don't know. But yeah, that's a bit funny. Al Treat says, I've been noticing that too. It really sucks. Sorry, it really sticks out on this sub. And I think other people are getting downvoted too. On this post, Coralette, Laura Y. Stitch, and J. Mama all have posts with 0 points. It seems strange to me when I was reading the thread the other day. I didn't even notice this. I was checking other posts just now and it doesn't seem as prevalent as I thought. But then other upvotes could be hiding the downvoter. For instance, I just upvoted one of your 0 points replies to me, even though I don't upvote much, just because it seemed unfair to be on 0 points. Let's have a look. All right, let's have a look here. These all have 3 points, 1 points, 1 points. Oh, there's a 0-pointer there. Okay, yep, I'm the points police. There's a lot of 0 points. That's really weird. So what do these 0-point ones say? Just kind of mundane, well, not mundane, but pretty normal comments. Oh my God, all right. Well, seems we've got a rat amongst us people. It's time to burn this ship down. Or smoke them out. That's what you do when you have a rat. Sluggy says this. I think the main problem is that we have several dozen contributors, but 3,000 subscribers. I doubt anyone who posts is downvoting anyone, at least I hope not, so I just try and ignore the anonymous trolls. There you go. Could be the case. I like to think that. It's some of the lurkers in this amongst us. We've got some lurkers, people. another thing some people do is they will try to make their comment the top comment. So they'll leave a comment and then immediately just downvote everything else in the thread. I don't know if that happens in this thread, but people do that on new. If you go to Ask Reddit new, because they want to have the top comment on a thread as it grows. So they try to get up to the top quickly and then hope that that particular thread grows big and theirs keeps floated to the top. Quite petty, quite childish. And I can't really see the benefit of doing something like that in a sub like this, because it's not ever going to grow and get on the front page or anything like that. So anyway, odd. Odd behavior from you lot. I feel like a disappointed parent. Come on, you guys. Enough of this. Pull your bloody socks up. Our treat says, the ball sounds like fun, but I can't help but feel like it leads to a more disenchantment for Emma now that she can directly compare her boring life to that of nobility. And it shows how different Emma's and Charles's approaches to life are. Charles was a little bit out of place at the party, but could perhaps enjoy it as a spectacle. He likely thought it was interesting and entertaining and felt lucky to go out, but is happy with it being a one-time thing, whereas Emma feels cheated that this isn't her normal life. Like with the cigar case, it's like Charles is likely thinking to himself, cool, fine, this is a snazzy and awesome, free cigars, excellent, smiley face. And Emma grabs it away from him and hides it because she thinks he's besmirching it and wants to keep it sacred and idolize it as some kind of magic relic of this perfect world. Ooh, I like that. I like that little analysis. The whole thing with the cigars was a bit weird. He found some awesome cigars. Why did she hide them? She just didn't like him trying to be the fancy thing that she wants her life to be. Swim said the Mum Fishy says, you understand these characters so well, and I love your observations. Please don't stop, three smiley faces. That was the comment that I said earlier that I don't think was meant to be directed at me. I think that was meant to be a reply to Simply Productive saying about her comments being downvoted, I think. Because I clearly am not the one here that understands the characters well, and my observations are dumb. So, that. I really need a drink. My mouth is doing mouth things, which is not, you don't ever want that to happen. So, hold on a second.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Alright, sorry about that. Thanks for waiting. Tonight's episode apparently is brought to you by some Aldi branded Coke Zero. Yeah. Which is a silly thing to drink at 1:40 a.m. But it's just the first thing I saw upon opening the fridge. It jumped out at me. It was that or beer. Apparently. Or water, I suppose, but meh. I don't have to explain myself to you. Let's read chapter 9, shall we? Goes like this. Often, when Charles was out, she took from the cupboard between the folds of the linen where she had left it the green silk cigar case. She looked at it, opened it, and even smelt the odour of the lining, a mixture of verbena and tobacco. Whose was it? The Viscount's? Perhaps it was a present from his mistress. It had been embroidered on some rosewood frame, a pretty little thing hidden from all eyes, that had occupied many hours, and over which had fallen the soft curls of the pensive worker. A breath of love had passed over the stitches on the canvas. Each prick of the needle had fixed there a hope or a memory, and all those interwoven threads of silk were but the continuity of the same silent passion. And then one morning the Viscount had taken it away with him. Of what had they spoken when it lay upon the wide mantled chimneys between flower vases and pompadour clocks? She was at Tostes, he was at Paris, now far away. What was this Paris like? What a vague name. She repeated it in a low voice for the mere pleasure of it. It rang in her ears like a great cathedral bell. It shone before her eyes, even on the labels of her pomade pots. At night, when the carriers passed under her windows in the carts singing the Marjolaine, she awoke and listened to the noise of the iron-bound wheels, which, as they gained the country road, were soon deadened by the soil. They will be there tomorrow, she said to herself. And so she followed them, in thought, up and down the hills, traversing villages, gliding along the high roads by the light of the stars. At the end of some indefinite distance, there was always a confused spot into which her dream died. She bought a plan of Paris, and with the tip of her finger on the map, she walked about the capital. She went up the boulevards, stopping at every turning, between the lines of the streets, in front of white squares that represented the houses. At last she could close the lids of her weary eyes and see the darkness, the gas jets flaring in the wind, and the steps of carriages lowered with much noise before the peristyles of theatres. She took in La Corbeille, a lady's journal, and the Sylphe de Salons. She devoured, without skipping a word, all the accounts of first nights, of races, and soirees, took interest in the debut of a singer, in the opening of a new shop. She knew the latest fashions, the addresses of the best tailors, the days of the boys and the opera. In Eugène Sue, she studied descriptions of furniture. She read Balzac and George Sand, seeking in them imaginary satisfaction for her own desires. Even at table she had her book by her and turned over the pages while Charles ate and talked to her. The memory of the Viscount always returned as she read. Between him and the imaginary personages she made comparisons, but the circle of which he was the centre gradually widened around him, and the aureole that he bore faded from his form, broadened out beyond, lighting up her other dreams. Paris, more vague than the ocean, glimmered before Emma's eyes in an atmosphere of vermilion. The many lives that stirred amid this tumult were, however, divided into parts classed as distinct pictures. Emma perceived only two or three that hid from her all the rest, and in themselves represented all humanity. The world of ambassadors moved over polished floors in drawing rooms lined with mirrors, round oval tables covered with velvet and gold fringed cloths. There were dresses with trains, deep mysteries, anguish hidden beneath smiles. Then came the society of the Duchess. All were pale, all got up at 4 o'clock. The women, poor angels, wore English point on their petticoats, and the men, unappreciated geniuses under a frivolous outward seeming, rode horses to death at pleasure parties, spent the summer season at Baden, and towards the 40s married heiresses in the private rooms of restaurants, where one sups after midnight by the light of wax candles, laughed the motley crowd of men of letters and actresses. They were prodigal as kings, full of ideal, ambitious, fantastic frenzy. This was an existence outside that of all others, between heaven and earth, in the midst of storms, having something of the sublime. For the rest of the world it was lost, with no particular place as if non-existent. The nearer things were, moreover, the more her thoughts turned away from them. All her immediate surroundings, the wearisome country, the middle-class imbeciles, the mediocrity of existence, seemed to her exceptional, a peculiar chance that had caught hold of her, while beyond stretched, as far as the eye could see, an immense land of joys and passions. She confused in her desire the sensualities of luxury with the delights of the heart, elegance of manners with delicacy of sentiment. Did not love, like Indian plants, need a special soil, a particular temperature, signs by moonlight, long embraces, tears flowing over yielded hands? All the fevers of the flesh and the languors of the tenderness could not be separated from the balconies of great castles, full of indolence, from boudoirs with silken curtains and thick carpets, well-filled flower stands, a bed on a raised dais, nor from the flashing of precious stones and the shoulder knots of liveries. The lad from the posting house who came to groom the mare every morning passed through the passage with his heavy wooden shoes. There were holes in his blouse, his feet were bare in list slippers, and this was the groom in knee breeches with whom she had to be content. His work done, he did not come back again all day, for Charles, on his return, put up his horse himself, unsaddled him, and put on the halter, while the servant girl brought a bundle of straw and threw it as best she could into the manger. To replace Natasi, who left Tosters, shedding torrents of tears, Emma took into her service a young girl of 14, an orphan with a sweet face. She forbade her wearing cotton caps, taught her to address her in the third person, to bring a glass of water on a plate, to knock before coming into a room, to iron, starch, and to dress her. Wanted to make a lady's maid of her. The new servant obeyed without a murmur, so as not to be sent away, and as Madame usually left the key in the sideboard, Felicity, every evening, took a small supply of sugar that she ate alone in bed after she had said her prayers. Sometimes in the afternoon she went to chat with the postillions. All right, excuse me, drink a break. Madame was in her room upstairs. She wore an open dressing gown that showed, between the shawl facings of her bodice, a pleated chemisette with three gold buttons. Her belt was a corded girdle with great tassels, and her small garnet-coloured slippers had a large knot of ribbon that fell over her instep. She had bought herself a blotting book, writing case, pen holder, and envelopes. Although she had no one to write to, she dusted her whatnot, looked at herself in the glass, picked up a book, and then, dreaming between the lines, let it drop on her knees. She longed to travel or to go back to the convent. She wished at the same time to die and to live in Paris. Charles, in snow and rain, trotted across the country. He ate omelettes on farmhouse tables, poked his arm into damp beds, received the tepid spurt of blood lettings in his face, listened to death rattles, examined basins, turned over a good deal of dirty linen, but every evening he found a blazing fire, his dinner ready, easy chairs, and a well-dressed woman charming with an odour of freshness, though no one could say whence the perfume came, or if it were not her skin that made odorous her chemise. She charmed him by numerous attentions. Now it was some new way of arranging paper sconces for the candles, a flounce that she altered on her gown, or an extraordinary name for some very simple dish that the servant had spoilt, but that Charles swallowed with pleasure to the last mouthful. At Rouen, she saw some ladies who wore a bunch of charms on the watch chains. She bought some charms. She wanted to for her mantelpiece two large blue glass vases, and some time after an ivory necessaire with a silver gilt thimble. The less Charles understood these refinements, the more they seduced him. They added something to the pleasure of the senses and to the comfort of his fireside. It was like a golden dust sanding all along the narrow path of his life. He was well, looked well, his reputation was firmly established. The country folk loved him because he was not proud. He petted the children, never went to the public house, and, moreover, his morals inspired confidence. He was specially successful with catarrhs and chest complaints. Being much afraid of killing his patients, Charles, in fact, only prescribed sedatives from time to time and emetic, a foot bath, or leeches. It was not that he was afraid of surgery. He bled people copiously like horses, and for the taking out of teeth, he had the devil's own wrist. Finally, to keep up with the times, he took in La Ruche Medicale, a new journal whose prospectus had been sent him. He read it a little after dinner, but in about 5 minutes the warmth of the room added to the effect of his dinner sent him to sleep, and he sat there, his chin on his two hands and his hair spreading like a mane to the foot of the lamp. Emma looked at him and shrugged her shoulders. Why, at least, was not her husband one of those men of taciturn passions who work at their books all night? And at last, when about 60 the age of rheumatism sets in, wear a string of orders on their ill-fitting black coat. She could have wished this name of Bovary, which was hers, had been illustrious, to see it displayed at the booksellers, repeated in the newspapers, known to all of France, but Charles had no ambition. An Yvetot doctor, whom he had lately met in consultation, had somewhat humiliated him at the very bedside of the patient, before the assembled relatives. When in the evening Charles told her this anecdote, Emma inveighed loudly against his colleague. Charles was much touched. He kissed her forehead, with a tear in his eyes, but she was angered with shame. She felt a wild desire to strike him. She went to open the window in the passage and breathed in the fresh air to calm herself. "What a man, what a man," she said in a low voice, biting her lips. Besides, she was becoming more irritated with him. As he grew older, his manner grew heavier. At dessert, he cut the corks of the empty bottles. After eating, he cleaned his teeth with his tongue. In taking soup, he made a gurgling noise with every spoonful, and, as he was getting fatter, the puffed-out cheeks seemed to push the eyes, always small, up to the temples. Sometimes Emma tucked the red borders of his undervest unto his waistcoat, rearranged his cravat, and threw away the dirty gloves he was going to put on. And this was not as he fancied for himself, it was for herself, by a diffusion of egotism, of nervous irritation. Sometimes, too, she told him of what she had read, such as a passage in a new novel, of a new play, or an anecdote of the Upper Ten that she had seen in Feuilleton. For, after all, Charles was something, an ever open ear and ever ready approbation. She confined many a thing to her greyhound. She would have done so to the logs in the fireplace or to the pendulum of the clock. At the bottom of her heart, however, she was waiting for something to happen, like shipwrecked sailors. She turned despairing eyes upon the solitude of her life, seeking afar off some white sail in the mists of the horizon. She did not know what this chance would be, what wind would bring it her, towards what shore it would drive her, if it would be a shallop or a three-decker, laden with anguish or full of bliss to the portholes, but each morning as she awoke she hoped it would come that day. She listened to every sound, sprang up with a start, and wondered that it did not come. Then at sunset, always more saddened, she longed for the morrow. Spring came round. With the first warm weather, when the pear trees began to blossom, she suffered from dyspnoea. From the beginnings of July, she counted how many weeks there were to October, thinking that perhaps the Marquise d'Anne de Villiers would give another ball at Vaubyessard. But all September passed without letters or visits. After the ennui of this disappointment, her heart once more remained empty, and then the same series of days recommenced. So now they would thus follow one another, always the same, immovable and bringing nothing. Other lives, however flat, had at least the chance of some event. One adventure sometimes brought with it infinite consequences, and the scene changed, but nothing happened to her. God had willed it so. The future was a dark corridor with its door at the end shut fast. She gave up music. What was the good of playing? Who would hear her? Since she could never, in a velvet gown with short sleeves, striking with her light fingers the ivory keys of an Erard at a concert, feel the murmur of ecstasy envelop her like a breeze, it was not worth while boring herself with practice. Her drawing cardboard and her embroidery she left in the cupboard. What was the good? What was the good? Sewing irritated her. I have read everything, she said to herself, and she sat there making the tongs red hot, or looked at the rain falling. How bad she was on Sundays when vespers sounded. She listened with dull attention to each stroke of the cracked bell. A cat, slowly walking over some roof, put up his back in the pale rays of the sun. The wind on the high road blew up clouds of dust. Afar off, a dog sometimes howled, and the bell, keeping time, continued its monotonous ringing that died away over the fields. But the people came out from the church, the women in waxed clogs, the peasants in new blouses, the little bare-headed children skipping along in front of them, all were going home. Until nightfall, five or six men, always the same, stayed playing at corks in the front of the large door of the inn. The winter was severe. The windows, every morning, were covered with rime, and the light shining through them, dim as through ground glass, sometimes did not change the whole day long. At 4 o'clock the lamp had to be lighted. On fine days she went down into the garden. The dew had left on the cabbages a silver lace with long transparent threads spreading from one to the other. No birds were to be heard. Everything seemed asleep. The espalier covered with straw and the vine, like a great sick serpent under the coping of the wall, along which, on drawing near, one saw the many-footed woodlice crawling. Under the spruce, by the hedgerow, the curie, in the three-cornered hat, reading his breviary, had lost his right foot. The very plaster, scaling off with the frost, had left white scabs on his face. Then she went up again, shut her door, put on coals, and fainting with the heat of the hearth, felt her boredom weigh more heavily than ever. She would have liked to go down and talk to the servant, but a sense of shame restrained her. Every day at the same time, the schoolmaster in the black skull cap opened the shutters of his house, and the rural policeman wearing the sabre over his blouse passed by. Night and morning, the post horses, 3 by 3, crossed the street to water at the pond. From time to time, the bell of a public house door rang, and when it was windy, one could hear the little brass basins that served as signs for the hairdresser's shop creaking on their two rods. This shop had as decoration an old engraving of a fashion plate, stuck against a window pane, and the wax bust of a woman with yellow hair. He, too, the hairdresser, lamented his wasted calling, his hopeless future, and dreaming of some shop in a big town, at Rouen, for example, overlooking the harbour near the theatre. He walked up and down all day, from the Mairie to the church, sombre and waiting for customers. When Madame Bovary looked up, she always saw him there like a sentinel on duty, with his skull cap over his ears and his vest of lasting. Sometimes in the afternoon, outside the window of her room, the head of a man appeared, a swarthy head with black whiskers, smiling slowly with a broad, gentle smile that showed his white teeth. A waltz immediately began, and on the organ in a little drawing room, dancers the size of a finger, women in pink turbans, Tyroleans in jackets, monkeys in frock coats, gentlemen in knee breeches, turned and turned between the sofas, the consoles multiplied in bits of looking glass held together at their corners by a piece of gold paper. The man turned his handle, looking to the right and left, and up at the windows, now and again, while he shot out a long squirt of brown saliva against the milestone, with his knee raised, his instrument, whose hard straps tired his shoulders, and now, doleful and drawling, or gay and hurried, the music escaped from the box, droning through a curtain of pink taffeta, under a brass claw in arabesque. They were airs played in other places at the theatres, sung in drawing rooms, danced to at night under lighted lustres, echoes of the world that reached even to Emma. Endless sarabands ran through her head, and like an Indian dancing girl on the flowers of a carpet, her thoughts leapt with the notes, swung from dream to dream, from sadness to sadness. When the man had caught some coppers in his cap, he drew down an old cover of blue cloth, hitched his organ on his back, and went off with a heavy tread. She watched him going. But it was all, above all, the meal times that were unbearable to her in this small room on the ground floor with its smoking stove, its creaking door, the walls that sweated, the damp flags, all the bitterness in life seemed served up on her plate, and with smoke of her boiled beef there rose from her secret soul whiffs of sickliness. Charles was a slow eater. She played with a few nuts, or, leaning on her elbow, amused herself with drawing lines along the oilcloth table cover with the point of her knife. She now let everything in her household take care of itself, and Madame Bovary Senior, when she came to spend part of Lent at Tostes, was much surprised at the change. She who was formerly so careful, so dainty, now passed whole days without dressing, wore grey cotton stockings and burnt tallow candles. She kept saying they must be economical, since they were not rich, adding that she was very content and very happy that Tostes pleased her very much, with other speeches that closed the mouth of her mother-in-law. Besides, Emma no longer seemed inclined to follow her advice. Once, even, Madame Bovary, having thought fit to maintain that mistresses ought to keep an eye on the religion of their servants, she had answered with so angry a look and so cold a smile that the good woman did not interfere again. Emma was growing difficult, capricious. She ordered dishes for herself, then she did not touch them. One day, drank only pure milk, the next cups of tea by the dozen. Often she persisted in not going out, then, stifling, threw open the windows and put on light dresses. After she had well scolded her servant, she gave her presents or sent her out to see neighbours, just as she sometimes threw beggars all the silver in her purse, although she was by no means tender-hearted or easily accessible to the feelings of others. Like most country-bred people, who always retain in their souls something of the horny hardness of the paternal hands. Towards the end of February, old Rouault, in memory of his cure, himself brought his son-in-law a superb turkey and stayed 3 days at Tostes. Charles being with his patients, Emma kept him company. He smoked in the room, spat in the fire dogs, talked farming, calves, cows, poultry, and municipal council, so that when he left she closed the door on him with a feeling of satisfaction that surprised even herself. Moreover, she no longer concealed her contempt for anything or anybody. At a time she set herself to express singular opinions, finding fault with that which others approved, and approving things perverse and immoral, all of which made her husband open his eyes widely. Would this misery last forever? Would she never issue from it? Yet she was as good as all the women who were living happily. She had seen duchesses at Vaubyessard with clumsier waists and commoner ways, and she execrated the injustice of God. She leant her head against the walls to weep. She envied lives of stir, longed for masked balls, for violent pleasures, with all the wildness that she did not know, but that these must surely yield. She grew pale and suffered from palpitations of the heart. Charles prescribed valerian and camphor baths. Everything that was tried only seemed to irritate her more. On certain days she chatted with feverish rapidity, and this overexcitement was suddenly followed by a state of torpor, in which she remained without speaking, without moving. What then revived her was pouring a kettle of eau de cologne over her arms. As she was constantly complaining about Tostes, Charles fancied that her illness was no doubt due to some local cause, and fixing on this idea began to think seriously of setting up elsewhere. From that moment she drank vinegar, contracted a sharp little cough, and completely lost her appetite. It cost Charles much to give up Tostes after living there 4 years, and when he was beginning to get on there. Yet it must be. He took her to Rouen to see his old master. It was a nervous complaint. A change of air was needed. After looking about him on this side and on that, Charles learnt that in the Neufchâtel arrondissement there was a considerable market town called Yvonneville-l'Abbaye, whose doctor, a Polish refugee, had decamped a week before. Then he wrote to the chemist of the place to ask the number of the population, the distance from the nearest doctor, what his predecessor had made a year, and so forth, and the answer being satisfactory, he made up his mind to move towards the spring if Emma's health did not improve. One day, when, in view of her departure, she was tidying a drawer, something pricked her finger. It was a wire of her wedding bouquet. The orange blossoms were yellow with dust, and the silver-bordered satin ribbons frayed at the edges. She threw it in the fire. It flared up more quickly than dry straw. Then it was like a red bush in the cinders slowly devoured. She watched it burn. The little pasteboard berries burst, the wire twisted, the gold lace melted, and the shriveled paper corollas, fluttering like black butterflies at the back of the stove, at last flew up the chimney. When they left Tostes after the month of March, Madame Bovary was pregnant. All right, there we go, another chapter down. And also, that's part one complete. We've just reached part two. Congrats. Let's do a little part one recap over at the subreddit. Have your say there. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.